And that's how I approach creativity. It's more, what are the habits I can do in a few minutes a day that will allow my creativity to express itself a little bit more?
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin. In this episode, we will be talking to Dr. Caroline Brookfield. Caroline is a veterinarian, researcher, and stand-up comedian from Calgary. She delights in using humor and immersive experiences backed up with research to sway the most reluctant creative. Caroline presents convincing evidence of the return of investment of creativity for individuals and organizations. Caroline has just released a new book called The Reluctant Creative, which we'll be talking a little bit about today. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you, Cindy. I'm so excited to chat with you guys.
We are so happy to have you here. You don't typically put veterinarian and stand-up comedian and creativity specialist into the same sentence. Can you tell us about your own creative journey?
Yeah, I think some people might find this a little bit familiar. You know, when I was little, I was very creative, like we all are, but I loved animals. So it was kind of predestined that I would become a veterinarian. You know, in the 80s, it was like, you know, which flavor of professional are you going to be? So I was always on track to do that. And then it wasn't until I hit high school, when you're really starting to think about your future job and profession, that I kind of got stuck, because I realized I had this passion for performance. I loved improv, acting. I wasn't very good at it, but I loved to act. I loved to be part of a drama club and photography, but I felt kind of stuck. Like I felt like I was on this cliff edge or this mountaintop, and one, I had to pick art or science, and I couldn't do both. I also have ADHD. So becoming a veterinarian seemed a lot easier, despite it being a very competitive program, because it was defined and the goalposts were there. So, you know, I went on to become a veterinarian, which has been a great career for me, but there was always something a little bit missing. And about over the last 10 or 15 years, I kept getting drawn into these creative endeavors, like acting classes or trying stand-up comedy or building businesses. And it took me a long time to connect the dots and realize it's all about expressing my creativity.
So Caroline, just listening to that story takes me back to something that I've been thinking a lot about from an episode with Dr. Sally Rees, where we was talking, it was an episode on talented and gifted, but in the discussion, this concept of multiple potentialities comes up, where we've kind of got lots of interests. And for some of us, there is a need, a desire, a motivation to explore as many interests as we possibly can. And I just wonder, listening to that story, whether or not you've kind of felt that, you know, that, okay, I want to go and explore starting up a new business. I want to explore being a comedian. I mean, can you speak a little bit of that? Are you making that connection?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I've heard that term before, multi-passionate, multi-potential. I think, you know, a late diagnosis of ADHD explains some of that. But even within my career as a veterinarian, like I always felt like, is this it? Like there's got to be something more. And within my career itself, I did many different things. So I worked in a zoo, I worked with wildlife, I worked, you know, in research and, you know, in research facilities. I worked as technical services, which is where I gained my real passion for public speaking, because my job was to educate and speak to people about technical nutrition. I don't know if everybody's like that. Is that your question? I'm definitely like that. So yes, I definitely resonate with this idea.
It's more of a connection that I'm starting to make more and more, because, you know, if I go over my list and it is a pretty substantial list. And of course, occasionally I sit back and I'm like, oh, if only I could just focus in on one thing, you know, or if only I did just focus in on one thing. But at the same time, it's like, I am not satisfied with just focusing on one thing. I'm not happy focusing on one thing. Cindy, is this something you can relate with? Because I know you can connect with the acting background.
I certainly can relate with both of you. And it makes me think about cognitive style. So if we look at something like foresight, which was developed by Dr. Gerard Puccio, he talks about a preference for ideation and having lots of ideas, which I think the three of us could probably relate to. Also in curtain adapter inventory, that theory talks about people who have an innovative preference, like a lot of change. And so sometimes I wonder if it's about, you know, our cognitive preferences. Like some people don't like change. Some people do really like change and not only like it, but embrace it and need it. For example, I need a lot of change. And if I'm not finding change, I change my hair or I change clothes or but I like to have something changing in my life, but that's my own preference. For some people, they might not feel that need to have lots of different areas of interest. But I think what's interesting about someone who is highly creative, and in a minute, we're going to be talking about someone else, which is the reluctant creative. But when you're someone that considers yourself really creative, you're always interested in new pursuits, right? So
yeah, that makes me think about a dimension that fascinates me called tolerance of ambiguity. I don't know if either of you are familiar with this idea. You know, people who have a natural, either genetic or personality predisposition, Cindy, like you were mentioning, to this tolerance of ambiguity, and those people are happier in change. And for me, a lot of it is about, you know, one of my core values is learning and growth. And I think that is what drives me. I don't know, Matt, if that drives you to do all the different things that you do, but I get to a point where with my businesses that I built, I realized that I don't like the operations side of it. It's so boring. I mean, I could probably make it somehow interesting, but I just love to build the business and then make me run it day to day, day in, day out. But I'm torn as well because I'm like, am I resisting something that really is the key to drive that success forward? And so I'm often thinking like, am I giving up too soon? Or like, is this honoring what I need versus am I resisting the thing that I absolutely need? If that makes sense.
I think that absolutely makes sense. And Matt and I can certainly relate to that. And we also love to build. And I think it's about finding partners who like the other stuff and find enjoyment in the other stuff.
So bringing this into a classroom environment, you know, it's almost like there's kind of two different teachers potentially, right? There's the teacher that is constantly looking to disrupt and change that learning environment, introducing new tools, new approaches to an assignment, new approaches to delivering instruction. And then there might be someone perhaps that has, you know, less tolerance for ambiguity, likes things defined, likes to kind of like predict the day-to-day operations and perhaps is less likely to want to introduce change to the environment and perhaps to a certain extent might even reject, you know, things that might bring about change. So let's kind of shift gears then and start talking about this kind of reluctant creative, because I'm just wondering, you know, is there a connection between that latter person and the reluctant creative? Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what is a reluctant creative?
Definitely. So being in my field, obviously, I'm surrounded by very technical and research geared people. And what I'm found is that when I went to work as a veterinarian and I had my jewelry business, I didn't really want to talk about it. I felt embarrassed that they would think it was weird and random. But I think that's one of the things that holds people, especially who don't think they're creative, back, is they're so worried about what other people will think. And when I started talking about it and owning it, I realized that it gave other people permission. And so people who didn't think they were creative were like, you know, actually, I used to, you know, do quilting when I was in university and I don't do that anymore. And then months later, they would come back and say, you know, you were talking about doing stand-up and your business and I started quilting again and I love it. So I think what happens is we get to this, many people can probably relate to getting to this part where you feel you have to choose art and science. And my point is that you don't have to choose. And you actually don't have to even be good at what you do creatively to get the benefits of it. So I'm trying to bring these benefits of creativity, of little c, small c creativity, to people who think they're not creative, who are doing creative things every single day. They're just not calling them creative. And so it becomes this barrier that they feel like creativity is not accessible to them. So not only do they get the personal benefits of, you know, better mood and more innovation and higher job satisfaction, but they also are able to be more positioned in the job field, because people who are very analytical left brain are their jobs are going away. So they're going to need to start embracing their creativity. And what I'm hoping to do is show them that you are creative. There's not no creative people. Everybody is creative. And how can you, as someone who's very analytical and left-brained, tap into that for future success?
So it's interesting because I just did a workshop with 70 educators last weekend, and I asked them, the first thing I said to them was, how many of you consider yourself creative? And talk about reluctant creators, you know, maybe half of them raised their hand. And I said, okay, let me reframe this in a different way for you. You know, how many of you have solved a problem in the last week where you couldn't search for Google for the answer and had to invent a new solution? And then they all raised their hands. And I said, well, guess what creativity is? Let's talk about that. And let's talk about that piece. So how do you encourage this? And I know you have sort of a five-step model. How do you encourage this with people? And what advice would you give, especially to teachers?
Well, for people who say they're not creative, I find a lot of those people are very data analytical driven. So I use science. I just pull out all the research. And so, you know, explain how, you know, creativity in the brain is not a left or right brain thing. It's a whole brain. So I try to tease them with a little bit of science to get them excited. And then I try to find easy ways for them to open their own creativity. I call it like breathing. You know, I can't teach people how to breathe because they're already doing it. So I feel like it's an analogy to creativity. But you could take in a meditation class or a yoga class and learn box breathing or pranayama to make your breathing more effective in certain situations. And that's how I approach creativity. It's more, what are the habits I can do in a few minutes a day that will allow my creativity to express itself a little bit more? Versus like, you know, rubrics and lesson plans and things like that. To me, it's more about a habit versus some kind of framework, I guess, if that makes sense.
And but listening to that, it's a recognition. I mean, I also think, going back to the initial conversation we just had, I think that when we hear creativity, we can still associate it with the arts. And so you reference people that might be very data-driven, for example. If they've got that interpretation that creativity is this idea of creating and making things within a kind of traditional art environment, then they may not connect themselves to that environment. But I think what you're referencing with that everyday creativity is that when we're thinking about creative problem solving, this idea that we're presented with an ill-defined problem, and if we think about an ill-defined problem, it's a problem that, you know, we don't necessarily know what the outcome is going to be. We're not even necessarily sure what the next step we're supposed to take in terms of trying to solve that problem. But we are presented with those situations quite regularly in the classroom environment, even outside of a COVID world. But obviously in a world of a pandemic, there was a whole bunch of ill-defined problems that we were presented with. And it doesn't matter what subject that you were teaching, you had to engage with creative thinking skills in order to design and develop solutions to address those everyday problems that we face in the classroom. And that is exactly why, whatever teacher you are, whatever subject you teach, you engage in everyday creativity on a regular basis. So how do teachers, what are kind of like some of the skills that teachers that's in their arsenal that they can use to go and be successful with these issues that they face every day?
People can be more generally creative or not creative in a typical sense, but we all have that capacity. And what I think the number one thing that teachers could use is a little bit of the E within that My Dance acronym. So E is for edit later. And I feel that that is one of the things that holds people back, especially data or more analytical people, because they're constantly looking for the right answer. It's black and white. And so when we're creating and we think of an idea, we immediately edit it in our own mind, like, oh, that's stupid, that'll never work, or you can't believe I thought that. And so we have to allow that voice to sit on the sidelines for a bit and try to be a little bit more open to letting those ideas come out. And then the second part of that is forgetting about what other people think about us. And so I find that the data-driven analytical people are all very worried about being right. And so sharing something with the world that is maybe a bit more ambiguous or maybe is a little bit more gray can be very difficult. And I think if teachers were able to model that behavior a little bit more in the classroom, but also engage in it themselves, they might find new avenues for teaching and also allow people to express their creativity a little bit more without feeling so judged from other people.
And of course, that judgment piece is to a certain extent so huge to a classroom environment. If we think, I mean, Cindy, I don't know if you've got some concepts about judgment, right? But we've had conversations about the judgment that teachers may feel from the administration. You know, what are they going to think about this new instructional practice that I've implemented in this classroom? What are they going to think about the modifications that I've made to the curriculum? And then we've also got this feeling of judgment from students. What are my students going to think of me? What are my students going to think of the creation that I've just shared with them in terms of the instruction? And we can very quickly make this a personal thing. Okay, so if they dislike or if I get some negative feedback on what I've introduced to my classroom environment, therefore it's negative to me. And of course, that's not the case. So Cindy, just, you know, you've done a whole bunch of things around creative thinking skills. Is there a particular creative thinking skill that can help address this feeling of judgment?
Well, I think edit later is very similar to the concept of deferring judgment and creative problem solving and keeping open in the work that I do with based off of E. Paul Torrance. And I think that you're exactly right, Matt. Like we are, as educators, when we try something new in the classroom, we do feel that judgment. And I talk with a lot of teachers who feel that vulnerability. And I remember in a recent podcast episode we did with Dr. Wendy Ross, where she talked about this added layer of parents also watching during this pandemic, where the parents were also watching what was happening in the online classroom. So we have all these layers of, you know, people watching over us as we're trying something new and how intimidating that is and how we have to be able to be good risk takers. And I know, Caroline, in a lot of the work that you're doing, you're talking about risk taking and how do we take those risks. So what recommendations would you make to help educators bring more risk taking into the classroom in terms of their own practice and getting their students to also take risks?
Yeah, I think that's key, getting the students to take risks. You know, I always say there should be, you know, I'm not an expert in education, but as a parent, I'm like, there should be A, B, C, D, E, F, and M for maybe. You know, we don't teach our kids the maybe enough, right? And I think that there's two parts of that. So the first part is that we feel judgment like physical pain. That's an evolutionary adaptation so that when, you know, thousands of years ago, if we were going to be excluded from our group, we would die of starvation. So it's very evolutionary to feel very uncomfortable in that space of judgment. But luckily, we have big brains. So I always say, use your big brain and think, when I'm doing stand-up, it doesn't really matter if the 20-year-old guy in the front row doesn't like my joke on parenting and doesn't laugh. I'm not going to die. And I always channel Ken Leung's voice from The Hangover, where he's like, but did you die? And so I think that, you know, first of all, recognizing that it's normal to feel that judgment as pain. And second of all, I call it objective risk mitigation. So when I'm getting ready to take a risk, whether it's jumping on a podcast and being interviewed or standing at the top of a ski run, I do this kind of check, this internal checklist, like what's the worst that's going to happen? And am I just worried about being judged? And in a teacher situation, like, okay, I'm doing this new approach, what's the worst that's going to happen? If the worst that's going to happen is the kids are going to get injured or it's going to derail everything, you know, those are all maybe valid risks that you kind of want to mitigate. But if it's just that the parents might think it's weird, to me, that's a much lower risk.
Cindy, I feel like I'm going to share with our viewers, you and I have been a little bit kind of like fearful of taking risks on the podcast when we first started. I mean, I remember we have certainly reduced how many edits we make in terms of how we ask questions. You know, we've been worried about how someone might interpret what we've said and how that might come across. And I think that, so it's something that's natural. Even we can, you know, produce a whole podcast talking about it. But I think in your response, Caroline, you highlight the fact that it is just, you know, a human thing that probably is in all of us. Some might be better at pushing back against it, but for some it might be a very powerful force that sometimes might stop us taking some of these risks.
And you know, when you say that, Matt, I think people seem better at it. Those people, it's because they've been doing it. We do it by practicing, just like we practice being creative. We practice stepping into that area of ambiguity and saying, what's the worst that can happen? And I propose that creativity itself, any kind of art, any artistic endeavor or making a meal, you know, gardening, anything you do that's creative is uncertain. So I feel like the more you explore your own creativity and step into that ambiguity, because no one's going to know what the meal's going to taste like until it's made. No one's going to know what their painting looks like until it's done. And I feel that creativity for people who think they're not creative, especially, is that place of stepping into ambiguity and thinking this might suck and that's okay, because that's what builds resilience. You know, in Karen Fuster and the University of Queensland's work, they looked at tolerance of ambiguity in the workplace, and it's most highly correlated with creativity and resilience. So if you can do something that forces you to step into that liminal space of ambiguity and face failure and come back and do it again, I mean, that's kind of the definition of resilience. So I feel that they're this like terrific trifecta of three things that can help everybody together: teachers, students, administrators, veterinarians, everybody, make them feel a little bit more confident in this uncertain world that keeps throwing new things at us.
So, you know what, for teachers out there, how I'm interpreting that last part is, let's think back to the first time we stood in front of students, the first kind of like time we delivered a lesson, that long pause we took just before we said, good morning, children, good morning, students. And think about where we are now, that comfort that we have when it comes to speaking in front of students for the first time, a new class, a new year. That is the same type of feeling we may have. Maybe it's a little bit more, you know, intense when we try something new and we fail. But the second time we try something new and we fail, it won't be too bad. And the more we do it, the more it would just be part of the norm. Okay, I'm going to try this new digital tool today. I'm going to try this new instructional approach today. And you know what? If it messes up, uh-oh, hey everyone, I messed up. It didn't work, you know? But as we go and expose students to our journey of trying new things, right? And let them know when it doesn't work, we of course are inviting them to do the same thing. And so I just love that A, B, C, and M for maybe, right? Maybe this will work, maybe it won't, right? But let's go on this journey together. And I think that speaks so much to building an environment that welcomes creativity from the students, and then also welcomes creativity from the teacher as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think if teachers can model that behavior, then we will have children that grow up to be more able to take risks. And it'll be a more interesting classroom for everybody. I think you're exactly right, Matt. We get so used to being in a position of competence that we lose that interest in possibly failing. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. And the better you get about mitigating those risks, right? So if you've done something new like 25 times, you can get a better sense of like what's the worst that can happen here as well.
So let's talk about dance, because that's a word that makes me want to dance. But you actually use it as an acronym. So can you tell us more about DANCE and this acronym you're using to live a more creative life?
Yeah, thanks, Cindy. I mean, I know with your extensive background in creative problem solving, so much about how creativity can manifest in the tools and the conditions. And what I wanted to do is condense it down into something very simple. For someone who's maybe not interested in developing their creative problem solving skills per se, but for someone who knows they need to do something a little bit different, maybe they think they're not creative, but they just kind of wanted something easy. So the acronym DANCE stands for, the D is for daydream, which we don't do anymore. So, and I am fascinated by the research, more recent research around how daydream can be more productive. So ruminating on that email is not daydreaming, but thinking about something fantastical is highly correlated to creativity, as well as daydreaming about something that's important to you. So I talk about just take a few minutes to daydream, whether it's what would life be like 200 years ago, or whether it's like, you know, if aliens came down and they were injured, would it be a veterinarian or a physician that would treat them? And how would you even approach that, right? So things like that are helpful for creativity. So that's D for daydream. The A stands for ambiguity, which we talked about already, stepping into that space of not knowing the answer and being mindful and being in the moment and not reacting in our knee-jerk way that we've evolved to, which is to jump to status quo solutions. So if you're able to sit in ambiguity and be like, it's okay, I don't know, then you'll be more likely to come up with creative solutions. So practicing ambiguity. The N is for novelty, just collecting, I call it your universe brain, you know, collect as many stars and planets in your universe brain with skills, experiences, relationships, and that's the fuel for your creative thinking. The C is for curiosity, because with great curiosity comes vulnerability. And if you don't wonder how things could be different, then how can you create a new solution? So C is for curiosity, and the E is for the edit later. So try to separate your divergent thinking, which is your imagination, anything can happen side, to your convergent thinking, which is choosing one item and moving forward. So I know it's not comprehensive. There's so much more to creativity than that. But I feel that there are five things that people can do easily in only a few minutes a day. And for people who are not used to engaging their creativity, I know that if they do any of those three things, any of those five things a few minutes a day, they'll start getting more creative solutions.
Fantastic. And I think there's a lot of overlap with many of the interviews we've done in the last few seasons of the Fueling Creativity podcast, Matt. I'm seeing the daydreaming. We had a really strong conversation with Natalie Nixon about that. We've certainly talked about curiosity and wonder with Jeffrey Davis on season two. And ambiguity keeps coming up, the ambiguity piece. I know we talked about it with Wendy Ross and Jonathan Plucker and Sally Reese. So I think it's interesting because it's not comprehensive and it is a great starting point. So I commend you for that delightful acronym. And can they learn more about this in your new book?
Yes. So my new book released in mid-December and it will be available on Amazon. So I would love for people to read the book. I tried to write it funny. I don't like reading boring books. So I wanted to write a funny book on creativity that's simple to read, and I put some exercises in there. I'm a big fan of Carrie Smith's books, the Wreck-It Journal and the This Is Not a Book, and wanted to include some kind of more interactive features to it.
And that's your comedian side coming into it. So those interests that we express find their ways into other facets of our life. And just before we close, I do want to go back to the e-edit it later. We did speak about it earlier in the show, but I'm making connections, of course, to design and iterative design, but also that piece of perfectionism. You know, sometimes it's not about trying to wait and for the perfect instructional practice. Just get it into the classroom, try it out, and then you can make edits later as the academic year unfolds. So, Caroline, we end all of our shows with asking our guests to provide three tips to our educators that they can take into their classroom, or three tips that they can take as thinking topics for their cup of coffee in the morning. So what three tips would you give to teachers listening to this podcast?
Well, first, I would like to say thank you to all the teachers out there. As a mom of teenagers, I appreciate you very, very much. And the first tip I would say would be to try to incorporate some more M's for maybes. I struggle sometimes with this black or white, yes or no, correct or incorrectness of school at times. And I respect and appreciate how difficult that can be, but trying to build in some of that maybe or ambiguity in there. The other tip I would say would be edit later. You know, just try something new. Nobody actually really cares that much about what you do if the stakes are low. And then the third tip I would be, make sure you take time to relax and turn things off and take time for you to take care of yourself, because we need you.
Well, thank you for joining us, Caroline. And thank you for joining us on this episode of the Fueling Creativity podcast. If you want to learn more about Dr. Caroline Brookfield, check out her website with the link in the notes. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This podcast was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with dadsforcreativity.com. Our editor is Sina Yousefzadeh.